Hollywood is facing its worst summer in 8 years, with the U.S. box office down 20%. So what's missing? Where's the summer blockbuster? What's hitting, what's not, and what's to come before Labor Day? Can Hollywood recover from the slump? Midday film critics Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reid take us to the summer cinema, from Dawn of the Planet of the Apes to art house films such as Obvious Child and a new Roman Polanski film called Venus in Fur. We'll also hear what Linda and Chris have to say about the acclaimed documentary Life Itself, about the career of longtime film critic Roger Ebert. That's next, Midday on Film, after the news. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us for the second hour of our show today. We're about halfway through the summer movie season, and the U.S. box office returns are down 20%, they tell us, over last year. In fact, Hollywood is facing its worst summer slump in 8 years, according to the news reports we've been checking. It's not because there's been a shortage of movies. There's just been apparently a lot of bad movies. I don't know what's going on. Christopher Llewellyn Reid does, and Linda DeLibero does, and that's why they're here. It's another edition of Midday on Film. Linda, nice to see you.
Great to be here, Dan.
And Chris, nice to have you back with us.
Great to be here as always, Dan.
Christopher Llewellyn Reid is the chair of the Film and Video Department at Stevenson University, and he blogs about movies at chrisreidfilm.com. You can find him on Twitter as well and on our Facebook page. And Linda DeLibero is director of the Film and Media Studies program at Johns Hopkins University, and they join us once a month to talk about film. And now, this month, we're going to talk about films that you've seen since May, June, into July. Some of our listeners, I'm sure, have seen some of these movies. Maybe not. Maybe they were excited, maybe not. I don't know what to say about this summer. Is there a reason why there's a box office slump? Does it have to do with content? What's going on? Chris, let me hear from you first on that.
Sure. Well, first of all, it's important to keep in mind that although box office is about 20% down from last year, there haven't been any flops on the level of last year's After Earth or The Lone Ranger. So far, we don't have any.
That was only last summer.
That was only last
it?
Summer.
Yeah, okay.
So far, we have no unmitigated disasters.
All right.
We don't have any of the super tentpole successes like last year's Iron Man 3. And some of the lower box office probably is attributable to the fact that audiences are maybe getting tired of these retreads of the same kinds of films. But, you know, I think we'll know probably a few years from now, look back, and we'll be able to analyze these trends. But some of the lower domestic box office is being made up for by increased box office overseas. And in China in particular, for example, Transformers Age of Extinction.
I saw you blog about that.
Yeah.
Transformers Age of Extinction is doing great overseas.
It's doing
right?
fantastically overseas.
It passed $1 billion or something.
Of course,
something.
Half of the movie is set in China, which probably helps. And you are seeing a lot of Hollywood studios add a lot of Asian storylines and Pacific Rim storylines in their films, probably to reflect this trend. And it's smart business because they are doing very, very well overseas. But as to why the box office is down beyond the, you know, the easy answer that it's because audiences are tired of the same old, I think we'll probably best be qualified to say in a few years. But I certainly am finding, you know, a lot of these sequels, you know, less than exciting myself. Though there are some good films this summer.
Well, we are going to talk about some of them. So we are going to point people towards some good films in this hour of the show. It's not all lackluster. Linda?
Well, it struck me preparing for this show. I used to do film reviews for mainstream papers back in the late 90s when these blockbusters, like this was the day of The Rock and Con Air and Speed. And every summer I would write about the summer blockbusters, and every summer I would decry the horrible devaluing of cinema and you know, this is a morass of horrible films, and civilization is coming to an end. And today, now, I just think, what, you know, nothing changes. Nothing really matters. There's not going to be a better movie season next year in terms of quality, or the next season, or the next season. Maybe I'm being
so
disappointing. Cynical.
Well, it's disappointing because in the summer, we're looking for the blockbuster, aren't we? Aren't we looking for that?
Well, yes, and I think that's fine. And in fact, I've become more of a just go with it kind of person, and I find myself enjoying these movies more than I used to because.
Which ones? You mean like a Transformers film?
Yes, and I'm going to proudly say that I enjoyed Transformers 4.
Really?
I'm the only critic on the planet, but I'm going to say it. Yeah, because I went into that movie. This was my first Transformers film, so I hadn't seen the earlier ones. But I don't go into these movies anymore expecting anything at all, except to be sort of overwhelmed by the spectacle.
Yeah.
And
that's
the
good.
Spectacle was overwhelming.
That's good,
I thought
Linda.
The transformations were kind of cool.
You've had a breakthrough, I think.
I have.
You get go in with low expectations, mm-hmm. and then you come out beaming.
I just can't care about it that much anymore.
I think my problem is that I have a huge love of these kinds of spectacular blockbuster commercial fare, and I still have a belief that they can rise above the material. One of my favorite films this year was Captain America: The Winter Soldier, which is exactly one of these big-budget digital effects kind of movies, and yet it had a smart script, good dialogue, and interesting characters. So I still hold out hope when I go into these films that they'll have those elements that make films interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
As much as I want to be, have these other special effects wash over me too. And there are some films this summer that have succeeded for me anyway in doing both. So I didn't have quite the same, laissez-faire attitude towards films like Transformers or even today's Lucy, which we'll talk about later.
Can we take some calls in this hour? If anybody's out there in our audience who would like to speak up on behalf of a summer movie, feel free to call us this hour, 410-662-8780, and feel free to call in and tell us about a movie that you practically wanted to walk out on this summer. We'll take whatever comes in over the transom, actually over the phone line. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. Toll-free long distance, good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. You can also write a short review that I'll read on the air. Keep it brief, please. Midday, our email address, midday@wypr.org. 21 Jump Street was a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
There's a movie out this summer called 22 Jump Street.
Which is a sequel to the first movie, 21 Jump Street.
Whoa.
Which was,
I didn't know they had made it into a movie.
It was based on the Johnny Depp TV series, 21 Jump Street.
Okay. Chris, you want to talk about, and Linda, do you want to talk about 22 Jump Street?
Yeah.
Okay, why? Because was it pretty good?
It was fun.
Yeah, it was fun? All right, go ahead.
I enjoyed the first film in 2012 more than this film, but this film is still fun, and it has the additional value of sort of making fun of itself as a sequel. So
I kind of like that.
So the TV series was out starting in 1987. It's what made Johnny Depp a star. And 21 Jump Street in 2012 kind of jumped off from that. It starred Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum as Schmidt and Jenko, two guys who sort of knew each other in high school, didn't like each other, but are reunited on the police force years later. And they develop a sort of unexpected friendship, and then they're sent to be undercover detectives to bust up a drug ring in high school because they look young enough. Now, sort of. And their age and the fact that they don't look quite young enough to be in college is made fun of in this next film because in 22 Jump Street, they're sent to do the same thing with the same names and the same characters into college to bust up a college drug ring. And if that sounds like a sort of similar plot, the film makes fun of that, as I said, saying that we're going to do the same thing in the same way and everyone's going to love it. And so it's a sort of this meta sequel making fun of sequels.
Yes, and it's also a parody of the bromance. It takes the bromance to new, unimaginable heights of transparency. It's about two guys who are in love with each other and they're jealous of their other male friends and their other pursuits, and it's very sweet and touching, and Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill have a lot of chemistry, and this film has what I think is the single major requirement of all of these blockbuster films: just keep going forward,
keep
propulsion, keep it moving. You don't get bored and you can't ask any questions.
That's what this is about.
Ice Cube is in this too.
He is, and he plays their supervisor, and in this clip, he's spelling out the new mission.
Same identities, same assignment.
We're going back to high school?
You look like you're about 50. You're going to MC State. Somebody's out there, they're cooking up a new drug. It's Adderall mixed with ecstasy, mixed with God knows what else.
Is wipey?
Wi-Fi stands for work hard, yes, play hard, yes. Now these kids get laser focused for about 4 hours of studying, and then they party like it's 1999.
We're going to college, for real?
Why every time you speak, I want to throw up? Infiltrate the dealer, find a supply.
I'm in there.
Yeah, it's,
I like this, the sound of that already.
Yeah, it's a fun movie, and I liked it until I sort of stopped liking it, just because it took, for me, like a Saturday Night Live skit. It just went on with some of the jokes a little too long. But I had a good time, and I would recommend that if you want kind of a fun, semi-smart comedy, by all means, go see it.
Yeah, it's clever and it's smart, and the end credits are fabulous.
Is this film still around, 22 Jump Street? I only ask mm-hmm. because I know some films are released in late May, June, and they don't last very long, some of them. But what do you think, Chris? Do you know? I mean, I hate to put you on the spot if you don't know.
I
didn't have a chance to check yet.
I do know.
Sure it
was
still around.
It was the fifth film last weekend.
Okay.
So it's still around. Still doing good business. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Hannah's calling from Silver Spring to make a comment about summer movies and going to the movies. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to say about this?
You know, it's not, you called in, I'm listening to the radio, and you asked if there's something about a specific movie, but, you know, I have a theory about movies in general. Going to the movie theater has become increasingly more expensive over the years. And, you know, mm-hmm. I'm a college student. I'm poor. I don't have a whole lot of money to go see movies anymore. And I think that contributes overall to movie ticket sales, box office sales. I have lived in Silver Spring all my life, and I have literally seen that movie theater down there increase in ticket sales from $6, $7, $8, $9, now $10. I just went and saw The Fault in Our Stars for a matinee ticket. And I think it's ridiculous.
What was the matinee price?
Matinee was $10.
$10 for a matinee? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to talk about Fault in Our Stars. But, you know, she's got a point. A film like the one you were just talking about, 22 Jump Street, like it made me giggle what you said about it. I trust you guys. But I'll probably wait to see that one. If I'm going to spend, what, $10, $12 for a ticket, I want to know that this is going to be a great film by a great director and involving great people,
right.
or some spectacle like Gravity or something
exactly.
like that.
Something where seeing it in the theater
yeah.
makes all the
yes.
difference.
Yeah.
But Hannah's absolutely right.
Yeah,
I got sticker shock myself because, you know, we go to mostly press screenings, so we don't think about the price. But I bought tickets to Dawn of the Planet of the Apes in 3D. $15 for one person, and I didn't think about, oh, the 3D films are even more expensive.
Right.
And this, it just struck me that, you know, why would people go to the movie? If you have a family, imagine how much money that costs.
And imagine 3D IMAX, which is how I saw Transformers Age of Extinction. That's even more expensive.
Yeah, but that's right up your alley there, Chris. That's what you love, right? It's like going out to a fancy restaurant for you.
Unless it has as stupid a script as Transformers Age of Extinction. But yes, you're right. In general, I love that.
Before we take our first break here, can we talk about Dawn of the Planet of the Apes? Because Linda just mentioned it. And one of our callers, Ann, wants to talk about that. But let's hear from you and Linda on this first, and then we'll go to Ann, get her comments.
Yeah, I think it's a great summer film and an example of the kind of film where you are getting that cinematic spectacle. It probably is worth seeing in the cinema. You can see it in 3D. It's beautifully shot, beautifully designed. It has interesting characters. And for me, it's almost as good as the first film in this new rebooted series in 2011, Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And, of course, all of this is based off of the 1968 film series and the book that was published in 1963.
Early 60s. Yeah. 63, was it?
Yeah, okay. 63 was the book. 68 was the first film.
The Rise of the Planet of the Apes was, what did you just say, 3 years ago?
Yeah, 2011.
This is a sequel to that?
This is a sequel to that. Right. And it's a really intelligent rebooting of the original premise of how apes became talking chimps. I enjoyed the original film more than the sequel, but I thought the sequel was pretty smart.
What do you think, Linda?
I think the first film was much better. This is the thing about the screenplays, their attempts to be intelligent. And I'm not saying that this film doesn't have its moments, but it's semi-intelligent. There are so many things when you're watching this film that you wonder about, why did they do that? Why didn't they do this? There's some kind of emotional core that's missing in this film. And part of it is that we just don't have any interest whatsoever in the humans. I don't care about any of them. You know who I care about? I care about Caesar, the main character from the first film. There's no James Franco there who he has a real relationship with. It's just really, you go to see Andy Serkis, who's absolutely incredible, and who is, if the film has any kind of emotional depth, it's in his face. But for the rest of it, I was really kind of disappointed. And one other thing I want to say about this film, everybody's been criticizing films like Transformers, the big dumb ones, for being a misogynist. You know, he always gets rapped for that. And I want to say, where are the women characters in this film? It's, oh, they're there, sort of standing around looking kind of, Carrie Russell is in there, and Judy Greer, a great actress, plays Caesar's wife. I think, you know, she's got maybe two expressions, wonderment and bewilderment. And it's just kind of, why are they even there? Just don't even have
them
there. And
there was a progressive trend of heroines in these films.
Well, yeah, and actually, we can talk about this later, but the number five film of the year, though, is Maleficent. So there is a market for female-centered films.
Oh, of course there is.
And we'll want to talk about that later. But I agree with Linda that there's a dearth not only of humans, but of women in this film. So in this clip, right, all the humans have died out from the previous film, except for a few. And here we hear a search party led by Jason Clarke, a new character, and they come across a band of these talking great apes led by Caesar, who's played and voiced, as Linda said, by the great motion capture actor Andy Serkis, who played Gollum in The Lord of the Rings. And the meeting does not go well.
We don't mean any harm.
They're apes, man. Do you think they understand what you're saying?
Do they look like just apes to you?
Dad.
Malcolm, what are you doing?
Dad.
Malcolm.
It's okay.
Go!
Okay, we're going.
So that was Caesar yelling go, telling the humans to get out of his forest.
Wow. So you liked it.
I did, but
what about that emotional core?
I completely agree with Linda. The first film was much stronger because we cared about the humans, and the relationship between James Franco and Caesar was extremely meaningful.
Anne in Baltimore, let's hear your review of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, well, I guess you guys have really pretty much covered everything. I have to agree. I was very excited to see the film because I totally enjoyed the first one. There was so much more plot, so much more creatively that the producers or directors put into the film, particularly the ending, which drew you immediately back into the remake. Because of the disease that begins to spread. And the way that they do that graphically is really well done. And it's how the movie opens. And that was pretty well done. However, the only real emotion, as you guys have mentioned, occurs between the men. Because I think actually, and I'm not up on all the simian characters, whether they're male or female. But the teacher, the giant orangutan? I don't know if that's a man or a woman. I think that it's a woman. And if it is, there's an emotional connection there with the young boy, the son of the human that becomes involved with the ape.
But generally, you just found it disappointing, too predictable?
Totally predictable. Yeah. I mean, if I can guess what's happening, you know, that's just not good.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Anne. And feel free, others, please call in other folks in our audience today if you want to share a comment about a movie you've seen this summer. 410-662-8780. Dan Roderick's here with Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed. You mentioned Maleficent. We're going to talk about that. Also, Begin Again. There's a new Roman Polanski film I want to hear about. Fault in Our Stars. Life Itself, the documentary about Roger Ebert. I'd like to hear from Linda and Chris on that. A short break. We'll be right back.
You're tuned to Midday on Film here on your NPR news station.
And before we turn to conversation with our critics, Linda and Chris, I want to hear from our critics in the audience. Angela in Waverly wants to speak up for Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. What did you like about it, Angela?
I've seen it twice. I'm going to see it a third time. But I loved, I guess, the intensity. I loved the lack of gratuitous gore. It was a violent movie. There was a lot of fighting, but I didn't see, you know, close-ups of blood or organs or anything. So I appreciated that.
Did you like the 2011 version of The Rise of the Planet of the Apes?
I saw that for the first time, I guess, like a week and a half ago, and then I've seen the theater version, The Dawn of the Apes, twice now, and I'm looking forward to seeing it a third time. I think I'm a little over the top about it.
Okay. Kenny and Laurel, thank you, Angela. Kenny and Laurel also had a comment about going to the movies in the summer. Hi, Kenny.
Hey, yes. Just kind of wondering why ticket prices don't usually follow the law of supply and demand. For example, if the movie is really good and a lot of people want to see it, maybe charge a little bit more. Then for movies that are really bad and nobody wants to see it, maybe they can lower the price.
Well,
you know?
Yeah, okay. I mean, think of movies really bad doesn't last very long usually, right? In the box office anyway, in the theater.
Right, and there is actually a theater in Baltimore, the Beltway 6, that usually takes films that have gone out of the mainstream, and their ticket prices are usually a little lower, so they follow that business model.
And those theaters that used to do that were a lot more plentiful back in the day, mm-hmm. and I think that's,
What's missing now?
DVDs and streaming and VHS all kind of ruined that, but mm-hmm. there used to be a time when it was taken for granted that if after a film had been in the theaters for a month or two, you could wait around and then see it for $2.50 in one of those bargain theaters, and that kept the movie-going experience alive.
I mean, Netflix streaming has not helped theaters, and it's really, they have such overhead that they got to be careful.
Let's talk next about A Summer Romance with Keira Knightley and Mark, is it Ruffalo or Ruffalo?
I always say Ruffalo.
Ruffalo.
And I always say Ruffalo, but I could be wrong.
That is the correct Italian pronunciation.
Okay, there we go.
But I think it's actually pronounced Ruffalo.
All right. So this is called Begin Again.
That's right. And it's writer-director John Carney, who made the surprise indie hit Once in 2006, which was set in Dublin, which was then turned into a Tony Award-winning Broadway musical. He's bringing us this yet another musical, almost romance, in which, as in Once, two sort of lost souls find renewed meaning in their friendship. They don't actually ever, you know, have an actual romance, but they come awfully close. And in this film, Keira Knightley...
So this is a close romance.
It's a close friendship.
Almost romance.
Which is one of the best things about the film.
Yeah, absolutely.
It defies expectation.
Absolutely.
Well, in Once...
Same thing.
Yes, it's the same thing.
He's following a similar pattern, mm-hmm. except this one's set in New York. And Keira Knightley plays this woman named Greta. She's British.
Budget.
Yeah, it's a bigger budget. Her rising rock star boyfriend, played by Adam Levine of Maroon 5, has just dumped her. And Mark Ruffalo plays Dan, who was a once hot music producer who's kind of his career stalled and he's an alcoholic. And they meet when Dan, drunk, hears Greta's music in a bar. And he has no more money, but he makes a pitch to her saying he'll produce an album of her music because he liked her song so much. And, it ends up happening. They end up recording all these pieces live around different locations in New York. But in this scene, they're on their way to a meeting with his former partner to discuss the deal he'd like to make.
So where are we going, Mr. A&R man?
We're going to my partner to play him your music. You got your demo?
No.
You don't have a demo?
No.
Well, do you have MySpace or Facebook or anything?
MySpace? No, I don't. I told you I write songs from time to time.
What do you write them for?
I mean, what for? For my pleasure. And for my cat.
Oh, really? Does he like them?
Yes, she seems to.
How do you know?
Because she purrs.
Maybe she's booing.
Lynn, did you like this film?
Yes, I did. I say that guiltily, right?
That's okay.
Guiltily? No, I'm kind of kidding. It has its faults, but, you know, a lot of people faulted it for being the sort of bigger production values, bigger stars version of Once. And I say, yeah, so what? I've become very laissez-faire indeed about these movies.
It is summer.
I love Mark Ruffalo, and he's splendid in this film. And this is another film where when there are certain certain things that don't quite fit together, you don't care because it's pleasurable. The music is fun. Keira Knightley was surprisingly sweet and had a lovely voice. And this idea of the almost romance, which he did so well in Once, is something that you never see in movies. Mm. Yeah, you know, you are pandering to the audience, right? You're, of course, going to bring your two big stars together. And he says, no, let's look at what happens when, as in
real life
you can't consummate this relationship, but you still have these undercurrents of feeling. And I think it's done really beautifully well in this movie.
Here's another film listed as a romance, The Fault in Our Stars. Let's talk about that one.
Sure. So this is based on John Green's 2012 best-selling book of the same title, The Fault in Our Stars. And it's a sad story of two teens who have cancer, Hazel and Augustus. And in the movie, they're played by Shailene Woodley, she of The Descendants and Divergent fame, mm-hmm. and Ansel Elgort, who actually played her brother in the Divergent series. And the book and movie are both sort of infused with what I'd call the indomitable voice of Hazel, whose powerful will to do more than just, you know, survive or cancer gives the tale a positive and life-affirming energy. And it's really a sweet film.
And she's, from my reading of this, she's on an oxygen tank.
Yeah, she's on an oxygen.
And he's lost a leg already?
He's lost a leg, which in the film he's wearing an artificial leg, as he does in the book. And my only real criticism of the movie, which is sweet, is that neither Ansel nor Shailene look like they're suffered or have ever suffered from cancer, whereas in the book the description of the Hazel character is she has, you know, her face is clearly that of someone who's had chemo, etc. But it's a sweet movie, and in this scene she and Gus have just met at a cancer support group, and it'll give you a sense of the vibe of the film.
Really? That is disgusting.
What
do you think, that that's cool or something? You just ruined this whole thing.
The whole thing?
Yes, this whole thing.
Oh, man.
Even though you had freaking cancer, you're willing to give money to a corporation for the chance to acquire even more cancer? Let me just tell you that not being able to breathe sucks.
Hazel Grace, they don't actually hurt you unless you light them.
Hmm?
I never lit one. It's a metaphor, see? You put the thing that does the killing right between your teeth, but you never give it the power to kill you. A metaphor.
Sorry, I set that up badly. Mm-hmm. He had just put a cigarette in his mouth as they walked out of the cancer support group, which is what she was reacting to.
We get it. We get it. Yeah, thank you very much, Chris. The Fault in Our Stars, that one's called. Mm-hmm. Linda.
Yeah, it's a 10-hanky film. You weep. Everybody in the theater weeps. You just can't help it. And you might say that this is an exploitive movie. It manipulates you into weeping, but while you're being exploited, it is perversely pleasurable and deeply moving all along. And I think one of the things that works about this film is that, you know, these kids have been just bombarded with irony all their lives. All of us have, you know, we're too smart-ass, too cynical to take anything to heart. And every time these kids put up that front, it comes down, and the irony is stripped away, and you feel this genuine emotion for these kids who play these roles so freshly and so really that you just are disarmed by it. So it's really a lovely film.
Thank you, Linda. Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed. This is the summer edition of our Midday on Film. Actually, they're with us every month, but we're spending this time in July talking about the summer movies. If you'd like to share comments about a film you've seen, 410-662-8780. Before we move on for some more reviews from our critics, let's hear from our listeners. Dale in Baltimore wanted to tell us about a film. Hi, Dale.
Hi. I am very excited about a film I've seen twice already called Belle. And you just finished talking about romances. This one is a romance wrapped into an historical context. And I've seen it at the Charles and at the Pike, but it's not in wide distribution. But it's a beautifully told story about a real-life person who was a mixed-race female who grew up in 17th 18th century England.
Yes, we heard about this, I think, from Chris and Linda a couple months ago.
Yeah, actually,
right?
I came on and I did a review of the film right after it opened, the day it opened, actually.
Right.
It's a beautiful film with this kind of Jane Austenian feel, set in the late 19th century, film that deals with race, class, and gender in a wonderfully innovative way. I enjoyed the film very much.
It's an amazing story.
Yeah, I don't really think of it as a summer film, but it is still out.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that one. Justin in Baltimore. Back on the subject of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Justin, what did you want to say about that?
Good afternoon. I know you've moved on to romance, but I just wanted to make a comment and ask a question. I thought the Dawn Rise of the Planet of the Apes was really emotional. Matter of fact, I thought the directors and the producers did a great job of having Caesar, which was a computer-generated character, show a wide range of emotions from frustration to anger to joy. To doubt and to confusion, and there was times when I was watching a movie that I forgot that Caesar was a computer-generated character, and I thought they did a really good job of having this character show emotion. And then my question to Chris and Linda is, I think a lot of moviegoers like the spectacle, but they also love the illusion that this is real, and when a movie has that, overly computer-generated stuff, it can lose buy-in with the viewer. I want to know, could you think of a movie where they did a really great job of the spectacle and also making it feel real, either this summer or past summer?
Oh, that's a good question.
I'll let Linda respond first to the emotion, because I think she had said there was emotion, just not in the humans, and then I'll give my two cents.
I think you're absolutely right about Andy Serkis and his characterization of Caesar. So it's kind of computer-generated, but there is a real actor behind it. Hmm. And I was absolutely stunned by his performance. I thought he was really... heads above all the other actors in the film, and really made me feel something for this ape. As far as blockbusters that have that core and that also give us the spectacle, I guess I always go back to the Bourne trilogy. I think that's
Bourne trilogy.
Yeah, I think that's really one of the greatest of its kind, and it just kept getting better, which is unusual for a franchise. I think the last one is the best one. And interestingly enough, one of the things that I think makes it so exciting is that it is not a lot of computer generated stuff. It's real action sequences. You can tell that they are real people having real fights.
Mm-hmm.
The character at the center of the film, played by Matt Damon, is a very complicated character. It's a political thriller. It's smart. And it's the kind of film that reaches, I think, across class, race, gender. It really has broad appeal, which is very unusual for blockbuster films these days.
And
what about Justin's question, though? A computer-generated film with a lot of special effects from CG, but also with an emotional core.
Absolutely. So I can think of just this year, a film I mentioned earlier, Captain America, the sequel, The Winter Soldier.
Hmm.
Both that and the first film, I think, are the most... emotionally resonant of the Marvel superhero films. He's my favorite character in both the first film and The Winter Soldier this year, I thought did exactly that, kind of invest the story with an emotional energy in the midst of what I call a CGI fest. And then there's a film out this summer starring, interestingly enough, Chris Evans again, Captain America, called Snowpiercer, that is being treated like an independent film. Maybe I don't quite know why, because it has all the elements of a big-budget action film. And maybe we can talk about it later.
Snowpiercer.
Snowpiercer.
Set in a future where a failed climate change experiment kills all life on the planet except for a lucky few who boarded the Snowpiercer, a train that travels around the globe where a class system emerges. And Tilda Swinton is in this. You like this movie?
I did very much. And interestingly enough,
Linda's nodding. Linda liked it too.
It's still two thumbs up. It's still playing at the Charles, and it's available on VOD, video on demand. So I think that's a film where you've got all the elements of big budget action thrillers, and yet you also have deep emotional resonance.
One of our friends on Twitter, Greg, tweeting us at Midday WYPR, says he loved Snowpiercer. Minimal dumb action flick tropes. Good story. And decent reveals. I'm biased toward director and sci-fi, though.
Yeah, because it's the same director. He's a Korean director who did The Host a few years ago. And I thought it was a terrific action film. And also, I have to say, coming up on August 1st, Guardians of the Galaxy, I think, has more emotional resonance than any of the other sort of
you've seen
temple
it.
I have, yeah. And okay. I would recommend
that, too.
And that's
from the Marvel comics.
Yeah, that's
well,
coming
right?
out a week from today.
All right. We'll take another break here on Midday on Film. You're welcome to join us with your reviews. And we'll hear from Chris and Linda some more when we get back. There's a Disney film we want to talk about, Maleficent, right? Which is based on Sleeping Beauty, right?
That's right, yeah.
Angelina Jolie's voice in that?
Yep. Yes, she's Maleficent.
She's in it.
And I do want to get to life itself. Let's make sure we do that because I want to hear what you thought of the documentary about Roger Ebert. A short break. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to Midday. Dan here with Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed at Midday on Film, looking at the summer movies. We'll go to the phone lines because Grayson in Baltimore wanted to add something to our comments about the film Begin Again. Grayson, go right ahead.
Yeah, I thought it was a surprising film because I was just expecting it to be the same sort of Once film over again, which I thought was really good, but whereas in Once the music and the skill of the music kind of overshadowed the rest of the film, in this the music was less distracting, it was also less good, but the writing of the first half of the film was just really something special that not even Once had. I do think it sort of falls off halfway through and doesn't hold up all the way, but the beginning was something that is worth seeing the film for a while.
I totally agree
with that. Thank
you,
Grace.
He's absolutely right.
Yeah, including the fact that the music's not as good as in Once, but that the writing is probably better.
Yeah.
That's good to hear.
The character is more well
Can I just go back to Snowpiercer for a moment?
Absolutely.
Do you both really like this?
Yes.
It's a sci-fi thriller. Maybe it's not a blockbuster, but it measures up to a good summer entertainment?
I think the reason it's not a blockbuster is because it was made by a Korean director, who has a kind of, you know, on this country he's an indie director.
Right.
In fact, Harvey Weinstein was going to make him cut the movie down. He refused to do it. And this was because he thought he was accommodating. I mean, Weinstein was trying to accommodate American audiences. And we also have two of the Korean stars from The Host who are featured in this film, who I think are the most fascinating characters and the most enjoyable. But that sort of puts it in this different category. It's totally not fair, but
okay, well, I'm glad you're here to recommend it. I'd like to see it.
But for those considering seeing it, it is otherwise a good kind of action thriller, intelligent, dystopian, post-apocalyptic vision.
He's very political, but in a very subtle way, and it's more than just an action thriller.
Here's a comedy, Think Like a Man 2. I know there was a movie, I missed it unfortunately, a couple of years ago, Think Like a Man. So this is Think Like a Man 2, but not the number 2.
Yes.
It's T-O-O.
T-O-O. And without the comma. Just
is
Think Like a Man 2.
This is the Steve Harvey stuff.
That's right. The
it?
First film released right. in 2012 was based loosely on Steve Harvey's right. best-selling relationship advice book.
What was
Think
that
like
called?
Think Like a Man.
Think like a man?
Think
or
like
was it
a man.
Act like a woman or
no,
something?
No, it was Think Like a Man, comma, act... actually, I don't know. I've never read Steve Harvey's book.
Look that
but the movie
up.
Was called
was
Think Like a Man.
Like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Act Like a Lady, Think Like a Man?
That might have been it. but, you know, this is not a great movie. It is, however, going to please the fans of the first film and the fans of the actors in it, particularly Kevin Hart fans, who's sort of a one-man comedy juggernaut.
Mm-hmm.
And he is very funny in this film, even if a lot of the other characters are severely underdeveloped. So
okay.
basically all the characters from the first film go to Vegas for the marriage of two of them,
mm-hmm.
And everything goes wrong, though there's a lot of fun along the way. And in this scene that I chose, funny man Kevin Hart, who's dressed in a skin-tight leopard print outfit, don't ask why, tries to take charge in this jail cell into which they've all been thrown after a crazy night.
You let me do all the talking.
Hell no.
What do you mean?
Why would we let you
what do you
do
mean?
All the talking?
Because I'm a season one holder of Oz. Yes. Have you seen it?
I've seen it.
Have you seen season one?
No.
Exactly, so you don't have the knowledge.
Everybody listen up! What I need to know is who's the boss in here? Because the new boss just walked in. That's right. Me and my crew, we just took this over. You got that?
Mercy, please.
So the film's been successful enough. Right now it's the 25th film of the year, so that's just behind Tammy. It's doing all right. It's just not a great film.
Here's another film is listed as a romantic comedy, an independent film called Obvious Child. Tell us about this, and then tell us what you thought of it, Linda.
It's the bravest film of the summer. It's a little indie film made by a woman director, Jillian Robespierre, starring Jenny Slate, the comedian who did one season, I believe, on SNL. And
she got in some trouble, I think, right?
Yeah, she did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of raunch in this film. It's very forthright. But one of the things that, I guess the one thing that really makes it different from all other films made about women who get pregnant accidentally is that she goes through with the abortion, and it's talked about frankly. It's taken as a matter of course. I mean, it's portrayed as a very serious decision, but there are no punches pulled, and it's about this woman who does what a lot of women end up doing, and it does
is she
it
in
really
a,
frankly.
Is she in a relationship?
Well, this is a one-night stand, but I don't want to spoil anything.
Okay.
There is a relationship that does
boy
develop.
Girl meets boy, girl gets drunk with boy, girl sleeps with boy, pregnancy happens.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree with everything Linda said. I think
you
it's very smart.
It's a very bold film because it's dealing with it in a comedic way?
No, because it actually talks about it in a way that's...
And she goes, don't want to have too much of a plot spoiler, but unlike films like Knocked Up and Juno, it has a different outcome. So it is going to alienate some viewers, but it's very smart.
What do you think of its listing as a romantic comedy?
It is.
It is.
It is.
I mean, there's a central relationship that evolves throughout the film, so yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do we want to hear a clip from
him? I'm curious.
Yeah, so in this clip, Jenny Slate, who plays the lead character, who's a stand-up comic like herself, is basically sitting around a table with her best friends, played by Gabby Hoffman and Gabe Liebman, and they're talking about what to do because she just ran in after about a month. She ran into the guy with whom she slept, who's played by Jake Lacy, who was on the final season of The Office. He was Pete. And so in this scene, she's sitting around discussing what to do with her best friends.
I can't believe he walked into the store. That's a sign.
And that would be a sign saying...
Like that I'm a present in a box and that he and I should go and start our beautiful life together.
You know, I'm not a straight guy.
Oh, what?
But my guess is that most of them would hate that gift.
What? You're saying that a guy doesn't want a drunk pregnant girl in a box?
If you're a serial killer.
Maybe you want to tell him.
No, why? Why? You don't owe him anything. You don't even know this guy.
Maybe he just deserves to know that, like, this happened, that I'm not a psycho, and I'm going to get an abortion.
You know, if I got someone pregnant, I would want to know.
If you got someone pregnant, I would also want to know.
So that just gives you a sense of the easygoing vibe of the film, but it's smart. Yeah. It's a smart film.
Aaron wrote to us from Silver Spring and said, I loved Obvious Child, which I appreciated for many reasons, but especially for its smart, funny female lead and its modern take on the romantic comedy. And a further comment from Charm City Chat on Twitter, who says, loved Obvious Child, brilliant film, sexy and fun, bad title though. Aaron,
it's taken from the Paul Simon song.
Aaron in Silver Spring also mentioned Fed Up. She said, I thought Fed Up was a fantastic movie, and sorry to see it's done so poorly at the box office. As a public school teacher, I would like to see it added to our health curriculum. Do you know anything about that one?
I think it's a documentary about
the
food system.
I
have not seen it, however.
I didn't either. But now I know the title.
Yeah.
Some more comments by email. I wanted to ask you this. You mentioned the cheap cinema, Beltway 6.
Beltway 6,
Is that a Blair Road?
Yeah, Blair or Hartford Road. I'm on one of the two. Yeah.
Okay. Is it on Blair Road? Beth says, in case you're wondering how Blair is spelled, it's B-E-L-A-I-R. I was giving the Baltimore pronunciation. Beth says, we like going to the second run theater on Blair Road. We just saw The Amazing Spider-Man 2 in 3D for $24 for two adults and two kids. Hey, that's pretty good.
That's pretty good, yeah.
They renovated a few years ago, and it's a nice experience. And we're patient enough to wait. At another theater, it would have cost $50 or $60.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that theater. I don't want to be promoting one theater or the other. I'm also a big fan of the Charles. But yeah, the Beltway 6 is a good place to see these kinds of movies.
Can we talk about Lucy?
Mm-hmm. Sure,
what
absolutely.
Did you want to talk about before Lucy? Anything else?
Well, we mentioned Maleficent earlier. But
let's do that.
Okay.
Maleficent.
Great.
Maleficent. This is the this evil is... woman in Sleeping Beauty.
That is correct.
I can't remember now.
Linda. People of a certain age will remember that she is the wicked evil queen the Disney version.
I didn't remember that she had a name. I'm sorry.
Yeah. All right. Yes. Well, if you read it as many times as I did and went to see it at the movies, you would remember because she was really scary. And this is Angelina Jolie in a live-action version of the fairy tale that tells it from her perspective. And, you know, I got to say, I have a soft spot for Angelina, and I thought she was really the best thing about the movie. I wanted her to be on screen a lot more. She revealed a sense of humor, a wicked sense of humor, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And the relationship between her and the princess, the Sleeping Beauty, played by Elle Fanning, is very touching but not very well developed. There's a lot of focus on the live action special effects that I don't think are all that spectacular, and so it has some flaws. But
you liked it.
Yeah, it's you can take maybe older little children to it.
I need to ask you here before we wrap up our hour. What you thought of Life Itself?
Oh, I loved Life Itself, and I think it's a good film for even those people who don't care that much or know that much about Roger Ebert. It's one of these wonderfully life-affirming films that shows the life of a man, and we start at the very end of his life where we see him, you know, missing his lower jaw in the hospital, and then we get the retrospective of his life. We learn all the things that he did to become the man he was. You know, he got over alcoholism and depression, met the love of his life. But it is at times hard to watch because we do see this guy that we were used to seeing on TV with Gene Siskel missing the lower half of his face in the months before his death. I highly recommend this documentary.
I think it was still playing at the Charles.
It is still playing at the Charles, yeah.
Linda, did you like it too?
Oh, yeah, it's very moving. I had read the memoir that Roger Ebert wrote before he died that the film is semi-based on, and I highly recommend that as well. It is not like the movie, so there are substantial differences between the two, and obviously you're getting Roger Ebert's perspective on things, whereas this is Steve James, the director's perspective on the last months of Roger Ebert's life. But yes, it's an extraordinary story. He was an extraordinary man.
Let me get some quick comments from you on Lucy with Scarlett Johansson and Morgan Freeman. And then also I want to hear about Boyhood. First on Lucy.
Okay, I did not like Lucy at all. I thought it's been called brainy dumb in a lot of reviews. I would just call it dumb. It's one of those films, a high-concept sci-fi film that has some beautiful visuals. But for me, the dialogue and the script were unbearable.
Linda?
Two words, Scarlett Johansson. Great.
She's great in this.
Yeah, right? And again, it's I do not come into a Luc Besson movie expecting smart, stylish dialogue or a plot that hangs together. But the sight of Scarlett taking down all these Asian guys who are after her is definitely worth the price of the ticket.
Richard Linklater directed Boyhood.
I cannot speak highly enough of this film. It's such an unusual experiment. He filmed it for 12 years, so we get to watch the lead boy actor grow from a child of six to an 18-year-old adult.
In real life.
In real life. In other words, he filmed the movie for 12 years.
Sounds like The Truman Show.
It's an amazing film. It's not 100% perfect, but it's got a fantastic performance by the boy who becomes a man, L.R. Coltrane, and Richard Linklater's daughter, Lorelai, plays his sister. And the two of them are amazing to behold. So it opens next week, next Friday at the Charles, and I highly recommend it.
Linda, do you want to recommend any other films for the summer?
I'll go along with Chris. I haven't seen it yet, but it is the film to see this summer.
Roman Polanski has a new film, Venus in Fur.
Highly recommend it. The lead performance by his wife, Emmanuel Seigner, and Mathieu Amalric are the reasons to see it. They're wonderful together.
Christopher Llewellyn Reed comments further about that film, Roman Polanski film, on his blog, chrisreedfilm.com. Chris joins us once a month along with Linda DeLibero for Midday on Film. Thank you, guys. Thank you both for these recommendations.
Thanks, Dan. It was fun.
Yep. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Lots of fun.
See you, Linda. Thank you, everyone. See you soon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Brian Gilbert, Tyler Downey, Anna Muckerman, and Evelyn Feeney. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at wypr.org. Dan Rojek's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.